Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology for a segment we call Underground History. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov of SULA bring in people and stories about archaeology and the intricate and fascinating process of truly unearthing the past. This month, we have a bicentennial to observe. Peter Britt, for whom the Britt Gardens and the Britt Festival in Jacksonville are named, was born 200 years ago, March 12th. The pioneer photographer and what he left behind are the subject of this month's Underground History. Mark Tveskov from SULA back in the studio. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Good morning.
Chelsea Rose, good to see you back in the studio.
Hi.
And Thomas Robinson joins us by phone from Portland, where he's the creator of the Historic Photo Archive. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Good to have you here on the Jefferson Exchange. Tell us a bit, if you would, about you and what Historic Photo Archive is all about.
The archive is a collection of pictures comprised of thousands of photographers' original negatives. And the reason more so that I'm here on this broadcast is because of a book I wrote about 30 years ago, Oregon Photographers, 1852 to 1917, which had an extended biography of Peter Britt, and along with thousands of other Oregon photographers from before the First World War.
That opening year of that that book span, 1852, suggests it really begins with Peter Britt.
Yes, he was the first one of the first photographers to be in Southern Oregon. Philip Castleman, I believe, is the only person who preceded him in that region.
So you certainly look closely at Peter Britt's work and his life. What observations do you make about his photography, either in terms of his time or today's standards?
Well, he was an artist, a portrait painter, and he, on the cusp of the invention of photography, it is said that 60,000 portrait painters in England went out of business when photography was invented, because what there it was an obsolete technology during the Industrial Revolution. Britt's photography was much more than just a simple portrait studio, which is what virtually all of the competitors of his did. He was also a documentary photographer. He was also a primary citizen of Jacksonville, and a real community leader as well. So he had a sense of history, he had a sense of art, and he had an enormous amount of technical skill. It required, especially in the early days of photography, it required an enormous amount of knowledge, skill, and experience to bring a photographer's work to fruition.
Well, he certainly had a sense of timing, too, knowing when it was a good idea to get out of portrait painting. Now, it's interesting to think that when we think about painted portraits, people had to sit for those often for long periods of time. Early portrait photography was often very slow, too. I mean, how long would people have to sit for the camera to capture their image?
Well, the evidence is in the portraits themselves. There will be a third foot on most of Peter Britt's early photographs, and that was in cast iron brace that was a posing tool that held somebody's back and head in position for up to a 45-second exposure required for the daguerreotype process. So that's about how long somebody had to sit still.
A lot of Peter Britt's studio made its way to the Southern Oregon Historical Society, where we can enjoy some of these fun contraptions today. They have the thing that would hold your neck straight. They also have a chair with a little secret hole in the back so you could hold your baby up. So there was a lot of behind-the-scenes happening to get these photos. These were by no means candid photographs.
Yes, that's right. And I think that what one of the more interesting stories about Peter Britt is what the Southern Oregon Historical Society didn't get, because his house was destroyed by a fire a couple of weeks after all of his photographs. photographs were sent to the museum. And I have heard from, the late curator of photography at the Portland Art Museum, Terry Todemeyer, told me that many of his friends thought that the fire was set by arson to cover the theft of a lot of the materials that were in the house. And there's a lot of stuff floating around out there that really should have gone to the museum in Ashland. I don't have any evidence or anything, but I think that's probably what happened.
So a bunch of stuff did go to the Historical Society, and then the fire, like 2 weeks later or something?
That's right, yes.
Okay.
So if this was such a high-tech process in 1852, how did he learn the technology? Like, did he read about it? And where did he get the equipment, and how much was it? Out of a catalog?
He apprenticed to a famous American photographer in Missouri, I believe.
St. Louis.
Yes, that's right. It was Fitzgibbon, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. Our regulars, Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov, back from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. And our guest is Thomas Robinson, who is an expert on Oregon photography back in time. He runs the Historic Photo Archive. He wrote a book about Oregon early photographers, including Peter Britt, who is our subject matter today. Peter Britt, for whom Britt Festival, Britt Gardens, you name it, any one of a number of things named after Britt in the Jacksonville area, because this is nearly the 200th anniversary of his birth back on March 12th of 1819. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Your thoughts about Peter Britt and his influence on the region, not just because he put his name on some things, or we put his name on there for him. 800-838-3760. If you'd like to join us by phone, send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So he apprenticed, but I mean, the photography process, you mentioned 45 seconds of posing, Tom, and then how long to develop the glass plate negatives?
Well, Peter Britt's experience precedes the invention of the glass plate negative. He started in the daguerreotype days, which was a process that involved boiling mercury and the vapors would bring out the image. But the glass plate negatives, which he later went on to master, and in fact, his first picture of Crater Lake was a wet plate negative, required a dark room to be physically present with the camera. So he had a dark tent, and the process involved coating. At the time, film didn't exist. What he would go in the field with would be a plain piece of glass, and which he would coat with collodion, which was a sticky substance, because what the picture was on was silver nitrate, and that would not ordinarily adhere to glass, so a binder had to be on the glass, and that was collodion, which was invented, I believe, during the Crimean War as a medicinal to replace soldiers' skin that had been burnt off during explosions. So it was a substitute for skin. So it was a very sticky substance. The photographer would coat the plate in a dark tent, load the plate in a camera back, put a dark shield in front of it so that it would not be light struck, attach it to the camera, and then take the picture. And then they would have to develop the film, not the film, the plate, and wash it and dry it before they could pack up and go. So that was quite an extended process.
So you really, in essence, had to bring a trailer up with him. I mean, a whole wagon worth of stuff to Crater Lake, which explains some of the issues about him getting to Crater Lake. Chelsea?
Yeah, and he did do exactly that. He brought a wagon with him that was nicknamed the Pain. So we go to all these places around the world today and take photos now on our phones, this very simple way to take a photograph. So when you think about what it took, and Peter Britt, it took him three trips to Crater Lake before the conditions were right to be able to take the photograph and develop it. And it was not a simple journey. It's not even a simple journey out there from Jacksonville today, but back then, you know, in the wagon, the Pain, it was even more.
Yes. Yes. I'm not sure how many trips he took. And there's so many issues around who did what, when, where, and first. I am convinced that Peter Britt did take the first picture of Crater Lake, because the only person who claimed that they had taken the picture, also the week after that event allegedly occurred, wrote that they couldn't take it. They had borrowed a camera from Peter Britt, and this was James Sutton, who was the editor of the local newspaper, the Sentinel, who wrote that he was unable to take it because of the smoke from forest fires. That's something he wrote a week later. I doubt that. I think that it required so much skill to take a picture. I just think he couldn't do it. He didn't have the skill. I'm not sure how he would have got around not having a darkroom with him, but it is known that Peter Britt was an early experimenter with a Canon dry plate process that was invented in 1865. So it is possible that he had fitted up a camera with a dry plate. But there were so many problems with Canon dry plates that his chances of getting anything to work were less than 50-50. Typically, the emulsion would fall off of the plate during development, or a similar problem would happen. So who knows whether a photograph was taken or wasn't taken, but it is certain that that the first surviving photo was taken by Peter Britt.
In 1874, you're comfortable with that as the first de facto picture of Crater Lake that lived.
Yes, that is correct. That is the first picture of Crater Lake,
and
for sure.
Two of those images were sent over to D.C. during the petition. There was a 17-year petition to get Crater Lake made into a national park. And those photos supposedly played a role not only in convincing the right people, but also in some of the publicity about what a beautiful and special place this was. One of the other things, too, I want to mention that Tom might be able to weigh in on is one of the cool things about Peter Britt and his long tenure in Southern Oregon is that we have one person documenting the valley and the people and the places using a variety of techniques. So the earliest photography, those were one-offs, so a lot of them went out the door with the customers. But then later on, you have stuff where you can develop multiple images off a single negative. And that's what the Historical Society and Southern Oregon University, and I believe the Oregon Historical Society, have copies of over 2,000 negatives that he took, because now we had the originals and could continue to reproduce them, whereas there's thousands of pictures that, you know, like Tom said, are just out there somewhere with the families who purchased them originally.
Tom, do you have any numbers on maybe how many people, just in terms of individual portraits that came through Britt's studio in the years it was open?
No, I've never thought about that. These different processes coexisted for a long period of time, and the way that this worked is that if you went to a portrait studio, any portrait studio, and you wanted to have a picture taken, the first thing they would ask you is how many copies of it you wanted. And if you only wanted one, they would take a tintype. And if you wanted a dozen, they would take a glass negative, because those processes were coexisted easily. They were basically the same thing, only different. The only difference really was the substrate, which was glass for a negative, or tin, which was a tintype. But I don't know how one could measure that. During the Civil War, it was required that photographers put a tax stamp on the back of a photograph, and so every photograph was taxed. That's how one of the ways the Civil War was financed, and perhaps there are records of how many tax stamps Peter Britt bought, but I've never looked that up, and I wouldn't know where to start with that.
Wow, that's an amazing record search for somebody who's into it. We're talking to Thomas Robinson from the Historic Photo Archive in Portland on this month's Underground History. Regulars Mark Tvaskov and Chelsea Rose back in the studio with us as we talk about Peter Britt. 200 years old this month. No, he's no longer with us, but he would have been 200 on March 12th. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. From our Sula people, Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, what observations can you give us about where Peter Britt chose to build his home and what you have done as archaeologists on that site?
He built his house when he first arrived in 1852. He kind of parked it on a hill overlooking Jacksonville, and he lived there until he died in 1905. And his family, his two surviving children, he had an adopted son or a stepson and then two other children, and they all lived there unmarried until they died. So what we have is this single family occupation, and after they died, nobody else ever lived on that piece of that property. So it's an amazing archaeological site, and we've been doing a lot of work there over the past decade or so. The Britt Music and Art Festival, of course, is on the south side of it, and it's a city park down on the north side of it. And we found amazing material culture record of their lives there, not only the stuff that Peter Britt had and used when he was there as a bachelor, but also toys from the kids and the food they ate. And two of my favorite artifacts that I think maybe I've ever found, which were two glass plate negatives that still had an image on them. So even though they'd been buried in the soil for well over 100 years, some of that emulsion with the image was still on there. And one of them is a photograph of a painting that Peter Britt did of a Swiss Alps view with a couple of goats in it. It's pretty awesome. And the other one, I thought at first was a stereoscope, but it's actually two exposures on a single plate of some man, unidentified man. So that's pretty amazing to see, you know, the personal lives of the Britt family, and also to get, you know, kind of the rejects. Maybe those plates broke or they weren't good enough for him, but, you know, archaeologists can kind of dig into the past and find those markers that are hidden.
You mentioned the Swiss connection. I mean, Peter Britt was born in Switzerland in 1819. And Thomas Robinson, what do we know about why a guy from Switzerland wanted to end up in a place like Jacksonville, Oregon, when it was barely a thing?
After Peter Britt served his apprenticeship, he emigrated to Oregon, as many people did during the Gold Rush, and he spent 6 months basically on the road, and he didn't like Portland, is what happened. He just didn't agree with him. That's where he landed, and there was a Gold Rush based in what would later become Jacksonville. And he decided to go there because where there's gold, there's portrait customers. So that's how he wound up in Jacksonville. And he was a very early settler of that area, and he stuck there.
So I was really struck by the James Sutton intersection with that story. And so, yeah, they came here in the Gold Rush, and then in the beginning of the Victorian era, and they had all these technological marvels. And I just was reflecting on how Sutton was our predecessor as underground history, because he was a newspaper editor for a long time at the local paper, and he had a regular history column. And both he and Britt were part of this Victorian generation that sort of set this new agenda for Southern Oregon as the pear orchards took off, and then winery and everything that made it what it is today. And it was pretty striking how that, like, sort of took over from what was before.
That's right. Britt was more than a photographer. He was. He did have a vineyard, and he did have orchards himself.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So lots of different talents in Peter Britt. Where can people go now to look at the work of Peter Britt, either online or in person, and maybe you see the actual artifacts, like what has become of his camera equipment?
Well, a lot of his actual physical equipment is at the Southern Oregon Historical Society, and it's not currently on display, but I'm sure they hope to rotate it out soon. A lot of the photographs are available digitally on the Southern Oregon University Hannon Library Digital Archives. So you can go through there and look at hundreds of Britt photographs that are listed up there, which is great. And we are working on ways to get a lot of the artifacts that we found available in a digital format as well. And one of the things to follow up on what Mark said that was really unique about Britt was not only was he documenting the region, but he was actively shaping it, both through his agriculture and wine and all that, but also in the way he knew how to communicate through images because he was an artist. So he was taking photos of the wild landscape and communicating that not only with the local population, but he would encourage people to buy those photos to send to their relatives back home. He also was made a lot of photos that were used in the stereoscopes that would be really popular later. And a lot of those were either uncredited to him or stolen. The images were stolen. But a lot of his images of nature also really shaped the way people thought about the world around them in the Rogue Valley.
And we've already talked about how his image of Crater Lake, that first one in 1874, was instrumental in the development of Crater Lake as a national park later on. All kinds of interesting stuff about Peter Britt that we have learned so far, and there's still more left to learn, just not on this program today. Underground History is a monthly feature that we feature with our friends at Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, Mark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose. Always good to have you back in the studio. Thomas Robinson at the Historic Photo Archive in Portland, linked from our website at jeffexchange.org. Tom, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you. I'm honored to be at the 200th birthday party of a photographer. My previous record was the 99th birthday of a photographer.
Okay.
Although both Mr. Britt and I are attending this party in absentia via